the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says it is opposed to any delay in the Palestinian parliamentary elections set for next month. The UK watchdog announces a formal probe into how Prime Minister Boris Johnson paid for the lavish renovations of his Downing Street flat. Also in the headlines, Russia expels 7 European diplomats in a tit-for-tat move amid its recent diplomatic tensions with the Czech Republic. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital of Tehran. This is Mews. Thanks for joining us. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has once again warned against any delay in the Palestinian parliamentary elections set for next month. The Hamas spokesman Hazem Qassem said all election-related matters must be subject to national consensus. He also said that any change to the voting schedule would be, quote, unacceptable. The warning comes one day before the Palestinian Authority is set to hold a meeting to adopt a unified stance of the upcoming vote. Palestinians have already urged the international community to press Israel not to block elections and occupy East Jerusalem al-Quds. This is the first Palestinian legislative elections in 15 years. Officials fear thousands of people in al-Quds may be unable to exercise their franchise as the process would require a green light from Israel. Leading rights group Human Rights Watch has issued a report accusing the Israeli regime of practicing apartheid policies against the Palestinian people. The report highlights inhumane Israeli practices from settlement expansions to the killings of Palestinians.
A prominent international rights group has accused Israel of pursuing policies of apartheid and persecution against the Palestinian people. Human Rights Watch says the policies amount to crimes against humanity. In a 213-page report, the HRW points to Israeli restrictions on Palestinians' movements and land grabs for the construction of settlements in the territories occupied in 1967, calling them examples of policies that are crimes of apartheid. The rights group said Israeli authorities have pursued intent to maintain domination over Palestinians by exercising control over land and demographics for the benefit of Israelis across the occupied territories. HRW called on the International Criminal Court to investigate and prosecute individuals credibly implicated in the apartheid and persecution. This says just a few weeks back, the court said it would investigate war crimes by the Israeli military in the occupied West Bank and Gaza Strip. This brings to the spotlight the fact that the regime has continued with its violation of Palestinians' rights for decades amid silence of the West in dealing with such crimes.
Well, I think it's very welcome. It really doesn't, to those of us who have any familiarity with the reality on the ground there, there are no real revelations, nothing new. And one of the thoughts that comes to mind is what's taken them so long to acknowledge these realities. But nevertheless, it's welcome that they are acknowledging them now, I think. And the report in particular, I haven't had a chance to read every word of it, but I've skimmed through it and read the summary and so on. One of the things it does that I think the previous statements in this area have not done is to do a pretty rigorous analysis of what international law actually says and to make the case that the realities in Palestine actually match the international legal definitions of these crimes against humanity, specifically the crime of apartheid and something that was new to me as a legal concept, the crime of persecution.
The report by Human Rights Watch highlights how Israel is practicing policies common in an apartheid regime. In this case, the persecution of Palestinians, both in Gaza and the occupied territories, is said to amount to crimes against humanity. Yet Israel continues to practice and execute illegal actions in the occupied territories, despite numerous UN resolutions and condemnations. The UK's Electoral Commission has launched a formal probe into the financing of the refurbishment of Prime Minister Boris Johnson's Downing Street apartment. The commission, which regulates party and election finances, said that there are reasonable grounds to suspect an offense or offenses may have been committed. Nonetheless, the premier denied breaking the rules, saying that he had covered the cost personally. He made the denial during the fiery exchange with the opposition leader in the House of Commons, Keir Starmer, however, came down hard on Johnson over the issue.
Mr. Speaker, meanwhile, he talks about priorities. Crime is going up. NHS waiting lists are at record levels, and millions of people are worried about their jobs, including Liberty Steel. Mr. Speaker, don't the British people deserve a Prime Minister they can trust and a government that isn't mired in sleaze, cronyism and scandal?
The controversy about the renovation of Johnson's apartment came after revelations by his former aide, Dominic Cummings. He accused the Premier of seeking to use potentially illegal donations to renovate his residence. Johnson has been under pressure to explain how he paid for the refurbishment that reported to have cost around $280,000. Prime Ministers are given $41,000 of public money a year to renovate the property during their term. The senior British professor has acknowledged institutional racism in UK's universities, saying more needs to be done to support black and ethnic minority students. David Richardson, currently Vice Chancellor of the University of East Anglia, said that there's a lot of evidence that points toward universities perpetuating systemic racism. He noted that students experiencing racial harassment put off reporting because of fears over their grades and career. Richardson made the comments while speaking to the BBC as part of a documentary entitled, "Is University Racist?" He also admitted that many students are not being told about the outcome of racism complaints because of universities' fears over data protection. The documentary showed some of the victims as saying that they were left dissatisfied and that the universities had failed them. Russia has expelled 7 European diplomats from what it called false solidarity with the Czech Republic. Russia's foreign ministry ordered the expulsion of 4 diplomats from Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia, and 3 others from Slovakia. The move came after these Baltic states expelled Russian diplomats following Prague's allegations over Moscow's potential role in a deadly warehouse blast in 2014 in the Czech Republic. However, Czech Prime Minister Andrej Babiš has expressed doubt about the alleged Russian involvement in the explosion. Moscow also strongly denies the claims. In a series of tit-for-tat measures, the two countries have expelled a series of each other's diplomats and embassy staff. The European Commission has begun legal proceedings against Anglo-Swedish drug maker AstraZeneca over its vaccine supplies. The Commission said the proceedings have begun at Brussels Court of First Instance. The Commission accuses AstraZeneca of failing to fulfill its contract for the supply of COVID-19 vaccines. The company is also accused of not having a reliable plan to ensure timely deliveries. The Commission says the proceedings could be concluded in a matter of weeks. AstraZeneca says any litigation is without merit. Under an advanced purchase deal, AstraZeneca had agreed to deliver 180 million doses of vaccines to the EU in the second quarter of 2021. However, the company said last month it would deliver only a third of the agreed jabs. The coronavirus pandemic has caused a crisis in India and Pakistan, as both nations are experiencing a record surge in infection and fatality numbers. We talked to our correspondents in New Delhi and Islamabad for a better insight on what's happening in the two countries.
On this program, India posts yet another double record of coronavirus infections and deaths amid severe shortages of oxygen, medical supplies, and hospital staff. The health ministry has registered nearly 361,000 new cases. That's the largest single-day total in the world. Some 3,300 people also died of the virus in the past 24 hours as India's total fatalities surpassed the 200,000 mark. This is while experts believe the official tally vastly underestimates the actual toll in the world's second most populous country. Neighboring Pakistan has also registered a new record of fatalities with over 200 additional deaths. The country's death toll has now passed 17,500. The government is planning to impose stricter lockdowns to fight the surge. Joining us on this segment of the news review, we have our correspondent Munawwar Zaman, who's joining us from New Delhi. Also, we have Kamran Yusuf, who's joining us from the Pakistani capital, Islamabad. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Munawwar in New Delhi. Munawwar, talk to us about the alarming situation right now in India.
The situation continues to be as it is, and with every passing day, we are registering more deaths, and we are registering more increase in the number of cases. If we look at the graph, it started with 200,000 cases every day, but today we stopped at more than 354,000 cases, and of course, more than 3,000 deaths. So the death toll and the number of infected people is increasing by the day. And as you said correctly, there's a lack of oxygen supplies in the hospital, lack of space for people to get admitted. Well, that was a different scenario altogether till yesterday. But now what the biggest problem and what the biggest challenge the country right now is facing is the shortage of food. People are not getting wood available to cremate their loved ones. There is a high demand for wood. And at the same time, there's a high demand for burial spaces. There is a high demand for crematoriums. Because what the government numbers suggest, I've spoken with many experts as well, and many are of the opinion that the numbers or the government figures that we see on the TV and the newspapers, it's just the tip of the iceberg. And we are talking about a country where 1.3 billion and more people are living. And it's just the state of Maharashtra, New Delhi, and Pune, and Bangalore, and Karnataka, and Uttar Pradesh that are in the limelight. It's just because of the fact, because you have all the national and international media on focus there. But if we talk about rural parts of the country, we don't even have the calculations how many people are dying every day. We're talking about adjoining areas. Let's talk about adjoining areas in New Delhi, which is Ghaziabad, Noida, and Faridabad. These are just adjoining areas, and we are seeing people flocking from there in huge numbers to get admitted in hospitals. Such is the situation, such is the critical situation. And today and yesterday, we saw incidences of doctors and hospital staff being attacked by the public.
All right, thank you, Manohar. Let's cross over to Kamran in Islamabad. Kamran, 200 additional deaths, which is a new record for Pakistan. Bring us up to speed on the situation over there, and also about some of the measures that the government will be implementing. We are hearing of plans to impose stricter lockdowns to fight the surge there.
Yes, first of all, I think during the last 24 hours, Pakistan reported 201 deaths due to COVID-19. And this is, as you pointed out, the highest number since the first case of COVID-19 reported February last year. And also the number of infections is also increasing in Pakistan. The active cases are now more than 80,000. And because of the surge of the COVID-19 cases and the number of deaths, the government has taken certain measures recently. For example, the government has deployed military troops at least in 16 districts to implement the SOPs to ensure that people implement all the protocols. Similarly, now after the surge in these cases, the government is indicating that they may resort to some tough measures, for example, imposing complete lockdowns in some of the cities where the cases are increasing. As you know, that this is the holy month of Ramadan, and during the holy month of Ramadan, usually the markets are full of people. So the government is trying to, prevent that kind of a situation. And there are indications that the government may impose strict lockdowns before the Eid festivities. The situation is at the moment is very critical here, and even the country's Prime Minister Imran Khan a few days back clearly stated that if the government and the people of Pakistan do not follow the SOPs, we may be becoming another India.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. We're going to leave it there. Our correspondent Munawar Zaman joining us from New Delhi. Also thanks to Kamran Yusuf speaking to us from the Pakistani capital, Islamabad. With that, brings us to an end here on this edition of the News Review. Do stay tuned. There's plenty more to come.
Welcome back. American aircraft manufacturing giant Boeing has reported another quarterly loss, sixth in a row, as the coronavirus pandemic continues to take its heavy toll on the aviation industry. The company reported a loss of around $540 million between January and March of this year. However, Boeing said that a rebound was within sight with the return of the 737 MAX to service and the availability of coronavirus vaccines. The company has been in a crisis since March 2019 when U.S. regulators grounded its 737 MAX planes following two fatal crashes. The regulators approved the jet to resume its service in November, but a new electrical problem found in MAX earlier this month has cast a shadow on Boeing's sales plans. Also, growing concerns over COVID variants in India and elsewhere have clouded the aviation industry's recovery. Iran says there are still major differences with the U.S. on who should come back to full compliance with the 2015 nuclear deal first. After meeting with the remaining signatories of the nuclear deal in Vienna, Iran's lead delegate says that there are still big challenges ahead. Pomalevsky reports from the Austrian capital.
Following another meeting with the remaining signatories of the nuclear deal in Vienna, Iran's lead delegate, Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi, says there are still big challenges ahead. As diplomatic attempts continue to revive the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA, the main problem is still who should come back first, Iran or the U.S.
The problem or the challenge is about the sequence of who should come first, who should come first to full compliance and full implementation of its commitments. On that, obviously, there are still differences. Our position is quite clear, and we are not going to change that.
Russia and China support Iran's demand that the U.S. remove sanctions in a verifiable manner first.
We believe it is the U.S. previous administration who first pulled out from the JCPOA. So it's just axiomatic that U.S. should abolish all its unilateral sanctions against Iran as well as any third party in the first place before Iran moved to implement the provisions on the JCPOA accordingly. So this is a fundamental issue involving rights versus wrong.
There are also serious differences on which sanctions the U.S. should remove.
Our position is quite clear. All sanctions should be lifted. All sanctions which are mentioned in the JCPOA and any new sanctions imposed after the adoption day of the JCPOA, including everything during Trump administration.
Up until now, two working groups have been trying to come up with a final list of U.S. sanctions that need removing and nuclear measures that need to be taken by Iran. From Wednesday, a third working group will begin discussions on timetables and sequence, as well as ways to verify sanctions lifting. Homar Ezgi, Vienna.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The limelight.
Now, at the same time that the U.S. criminal legal system is congratulating itself for sending Chauvin to prison, the very protests that brought the case to national attention are being criminalized, says Barbara Ransby, author, in an article published under the heading Mass Protest Led to Chauvin's Conviction. Now they are being criminalized. Stay tuned for more. Former Minneapolis cop Derek Chauvin was convicted on all charges in the brutal public lynching of George Floyd. For the Floyd family, the conviction offered some solace. that the courts did not allow Floyd's life to be taken with impunity. For many of Americans, however, it was a hollow victory, not only because prisons doesn't solve their problems, but because they know police don't either. While the trial convicted Chauvin, as an individual, it sought to exonerate the larger system of policing, which is violent to the core. This is not an anti-police prosecution, the state's attorney insisted. It's a pro-police prosecution. Chauvin was portrayed as a rogue cop out of sync with his fellow police officers. His violent behavior was portrayed as the exception, not the rule. And the system proved it was just by convicting him swiftly. This was the skewed narrative offered in pundit land while victims of racist police violence kept dying. Police in the U.S. have killed at least 64 civilians since the trial began, with the killings of Daunte Wright, 20, and Adam Toledo, 13, and Makia Bryant, 16, being the most recent high-profile examples. George Floyd's murder was not an isolated incident, but rather a part of a larger intentional pattern of racist state violence targeting poor and working-class black and brown communities. Past precedent shows there would have been no reckoning, even a limited and flawed reckoning, had there not been the massive protests that swept the U.S. in the wake of Floyd's murder. Now, at the same time that the criminal legal system is congratulating itself for sending Chauvin to the prison, the very protests that brought the case to national attention are being criminalized. This week, after making the racist assertion that media police officials allowed protesters to run wild in the streets, Governor Ron DeSantis signed an ominous bill that seeks to essentially criminalize protests in the state of Florida, clearly targeting protests under the banner of Black Lives Matter. It is a dangerous harbinger of what may be in store for other parts of the U.S. Indeed, the New York Times reports that GOP lawmakers in 34 states have introduced 81 anti-protest bills during the 2021 legislative session, more than twice as many proposals as in any other year. The bottom line is that while all eyes are on Minnesota, Florida House Bill 1 dubbed the anti-riot bill, and other looming bills like it have potential to have a far greater impact on movements to combat racialized state violence than the Chauvin conviction. Chauvin murdered Floyd in broad daylight in front of witnesses, and it was recorded. This was an egregious case of wanton violence, and fortunately, the jury agreed. But what is the takeaway? That the criminal legal system has overcome 400 years of systematic, deep-seated racism by holding a single police officer accountable for the kind of racist violence that has become all too routine? That is the wrong conclusion. It is not only ahistorical and short-sighted, but it gives a distorted sense of progress. To let one cop, albeit a racist and violent one, be the scapegoat for a systematic set of problems is to deny the systematic nature of those very problems. Daunte Wright's mother was eloquent when she said justice would bring our son home to us and there is never going to be justice for us. She went on to say that there can and should be accountability for her son's murder at the hands of yet another Minnesota police officer. However, she understood that the demand for justice requires something much more. All of that said, two things are important to remember. Cops should certainly not get special exemptions for heinous acts of violence. And secondly, however, locking up one's cop won't bring back American murdered children, neighbors, friends, and loved ones, nor will it prevent future violence. What is necessary is fundamental systematic change. The new Florida anti-protest law puts a formidable obstacle in the path to this kind of systematic change by subverting the movements that have been principal catalysts for change. The law criminalizes protests that obstruct traffic and makes defacing monuments a felony. It also punishes local governments that decline to be heavy-handed in suppressing protests, mandating that local officials will be charged for damages done in such protests. It calls for 6-month mandatory sentencing for any protester who commits assault upon a police officer. Of course, there are many cases where protesters are being beaten and their deflection of blows gets conveniently labeled as assault. The law also uses the language of mob intimidation, which is defined vaguely as 3 or more people acting with intent to force another to take their viewpoints. It is unimaginable how such a law could be freely enforced. Conceivably, a political argument on a street corner could be cause for arrest. If this is not censorship, so what is it? Another particularly disturbing feature of the bill is that it prevents people from being bailed out of jail until their first court appearance, which essentially mandates detention of protesters prior to a conviction for any crime. This is reminiscent of the detention without charge policies that characterize dictatorships around the world and regimes like the former apartheid system in South Africa. As others have pointed out, many of the behaviors stipulated in the law are already in criminal statutes and is therefore redundant, but designed to intimidate and deter activists. It is important that we make sense of these linkages between the Florida law and the skewed framing of the Derek Chauvin trial. The only reason there is a trial in Hennepin County, Minnesota for the heinous murder of George Floyd in broad daylight is because there were loud and persistent protests in the streets of the U.S. Had there not been protests, there would have likely been an accidental death report, no investigation, and no trial. In fact, the initial press release from the police before video surfaced was a complete cover-up. So, the Florida law prevents an important mechanism for achieving a modicum of justice, which is the right of the citizens and residents to protest. The challenge to social movements then is to be over-courageous and creative in speaking truth to power. No matter what censoring measures those in power attempt to impose in Florida and beyond. As Minneapolis Black Visions collective leader Candace Montgomery insists, the fight for justice is far from over.
سبحان الله والحمد لله لا إله إلا الله والله أكبر لا إله إلا الله.
Let's listen to the famous reciters of the Holy Quran in the month of Allah.
سبحان الله
Brother Muhammad Reza Birya, only in IRIB English Radio.
In the name of Allah, Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. Welcome to this segment of the month of Allah. In this segment, we're going to talk about famous reciters of the world of Islam. And we're going to listen to a wonderful recitation, a short recitation by that reciter. Today, we're going to talk about the famous great reciter, Sheikh Abdul Fattah Shashai. Sheikh Abdul Fattah Shashai was born in 1890 in a village called Shasha, and that's where he gets his name, Shashai. He memorized the whole Quran at the age of 10. And then, of course, he learned the rules of Tajweed and also the Quranic sciences and, of course, the Maqamat. Sheikh Abdul Fattah Shashai became famous when he recited the Quran on the eve of Imam Hussein's birthday next to great reciters such as Sheikh Muhammad Rifat, Ahmad Nada, and Sheikh Ali Mahmoud. Now, I could say a lot about the style of recitation of this great reciter, Sheikh Abdul Fattah Shashai. Probably the best thing that can be said about Sheikh Abdul Fattah Shashai is that he would convey the meaning of the verses of the Quran through his tone, the maqamat, intonation, and also the stress that he applied to certain words. Someone said that if all reciters are like painters who, you know, they paint something and they try to convey the meaning through a painting, Sheikh Abdul Fattah Shashai is like a sculptor who makes statues, and in that way he conveys the meaning, illustrates the meaning of the verses of the Quran. He has a very powerful voice. It's said that before the microphone was invented, reciters who had powerful voices, such as Abdul Fattah Taruti, were very famous because, you know, they were able to recite the Quran very loudly, for example, in a mosque, and everyone would be able to hear and listen to his recitation clearly. Those with weaker voices were not as famous. But once the microphone was invented, even those with weaker voices, as Sheikh Abdul Fattah Shashai, such as Muhammad Rifat, who had a weaker voice compared to Sheikh Abdul Fattah Shashai, became famous. Brothers and sisters, let me just give you an example of how Sheikh Shashai would convey the meaning of the verses of the Quran through the use of his voice, intonation, and also the maqamat. In this recitation that we're going to listen to, Surah Maryam, when Sheikh Shashai reaches the word As-Salah, he uses the highest register of his voice. He raises his voice. It's as if someone is upholding prayer. Because, you know, we have in the Quran that prayer must be upheld. أقم الصلاة. And this is what Sheikh Shashai shows and depicts through his voice. And he uses the Jawabul Jawab on the word As-Salah. This is probably the only place where Sheikh Shashai uses Jawabul Jawab of his voice. And he wants to draw the attention of the listeners to the importance of the concept of Salah. Now let's listen to this recitation by Sheikh Abdul Fattah Shashai, Surah Maryam, verses 51 to 55.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
واذكر في الكتاب موسى إنه كان مخلصا وكان رسولا نبيا وناديناه من جانب الطور الأيمن وقربناه نجيا ووهبنا له من رحمتنا أخاه هارون نبيا واذكر في الكتاب إسماعيل إنه كان صادق الوعد وكان رسولا نبيا وكان يأمر أهله بالصلاة والزكاة وكان عند ربه مرضيا صدق الله العظيم.
And mention in the book Moses. Indeed, he was chosen, and he was a messenger and a prophet. And we called him from the side of the mount at his right, and brought him near, confiding to him. And we gave him out of our mercy his brother Aaron as a prophet. And mention in the book Ishmael. Indeed, he was true to his promise, and he was a messenger and a prophet. And he used to enjoin on his people prayer and zakah, and was to his Lord pleasing.
رحمن يا رحمن ساعدني يا رحمن اشرح صدري قرآن املأ قلبي قرآن واسق حياتي قرآن.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
Comparison of the number of doses of vaccines manufactured by the rich countries with the number of doses used by them in their own countries provides a clear picture of the extent of vaccine apartheid practiced by these countries. An article published in the New York Times in late March reveals residents of wealthy and middle-income countries have received about 90% of the nearly 400 million vaccines delivered so far. We now present you a two-part article written by Prabir Purkayaswa, the founding editor of Newsclick.in, a digital media platform. The piece is titled, The West Practicing Vaccine Apartheid at a Global Level. More than an eighth of the world's population living in rich countries, the United States, Canada, the United Kingdom, and the European Union have access to more than 50% of the world's COVID-19 vaccine doses. According to Our World in Data, about 112 million people in the United States alone received at least a single inoculation by 8th of April. This is more than 12 times the total number of people vaccinated in the entire continent of Africa, which has four times the population of the United States. On 8th of April, the World Health Organization WHO said that nearly 13 million of the 31.6 million doses delivered so far to 45 African countries have been administered. And if we do not count the vaccine doses that have been administered in Morocco, truly an outlier in Africa, as of 8th of April, the United States has received almost 35 times the vaccine doses that Africa has. No wonder Dr. Tedros Ghebreyesus, the World Health Organization's Director General, called the distribution of vaccines grotesque and a catastrophic moral failure. Let us not call reserving the bulk of vaccines for a handful of rich ex-colonial or settler colonial states vaccine nationalism. Let us call it what it is: vaccine apartheid at a global level. How much of the COVID-19 vaccine manufactured in the rich countries has gone to the rest of the world? The answer is that the rich countries have kept their supplies almost entirely to themselves. Moderna's vaccine production has mostly been used to inoculate the population in the United States, besides supplying it to some countries in Europe and also to Canada. Pfizer has supplied its vaccines to the United States from its U.S. facilities, and to Europe and to the United Kingdom from its European plants. It has also supplied vaccines to the occupied Palestine and the Persian Gulf monarchies, and begrudgingly, parts of Latin America, but that makes up a small fraction of its total production. The rich countries have had some squabbles with one another over vaccine supplies. An example of this is the clash between the European Union and the pharmaceutical company AstraZeneca and the United Kingdom. Perhaps this is why they have had no time to think about the rest of the world. A comparison of the number of doses manufactured by the rich countries with the number of doses used by them in their own countries provides a clear picture of the extent of vaccine apartheid practiced by these countries. An article published in the New York Times in late March reveals residents of wealthy and middle-income countries have received about 90% of the nearly 400 million vaccines delivered so far. Where has the rest of the world gotten its vaccines from? It appears that the only other sources of vaccine for low- and middle-income countries are those being produced by China and India, with Russia providing smaller amounts of vaccines. This is substantiated by various press sources that recount how countries in Latin America, Eastern Europe, Africa, and Southeast Asia are receiving supplies from China, India, or Russia. How much of the vaccine supplies from Sinovac, a Beijing-based biopharmaceutical company, and Sinopharm, a Chinese state-owned company, was administered locally in China, and how much has been provided to the rest of the world? According to a 5th of April article in Nikkei Asia, which relied on data provided by Air Infinity, an analytics company, about 115 million doses of the vaccine have been used in China, and the same amount has gone to the rest of the world. Similarly, based on the figures released by India's Ministry of External Affairs website on 15th of April, more than 65 million doses of the vaccine produced by the Serum Institute Covishield vaccine licensed from AstraZeneca have been exported to other countries. With the surge in the rate of infection in India recently, the doses exported from that country have fallen in comparison with the number of vaccine doses it has administered to its own population. According to a 13th of April article in Deutsche Welle, more than 104.5 million people in India have received at least one dose of the inoculation, whilst India has shipped more than 60 million doses of the vaccine to 76 nations. China, India, and Russia are the only three major countries that have been willing to export vaccines whilst also vaccinating their own populations. To curtail the sharp rise of COVID-19 cases in India, the country is currently prioritizing its supplies and has temporarily halted exports of vaccines from India. This has slowed down vaccine supplies to other countries significantly, particularly in March and April, and will impact the COVAX program, particularly in Africa, which is heavily dependent on the World Health Organization's Access to COVID-19 Tools, or ACT Accelerator Program, and its vaccine pillar of COVAX. The Sputnik V, developed by the highly respected Gamaleya National Center of Epidemiology, has shown its efficacy in clinical trials. However, ramping up its production has been slow. Russia's production capacity of vaccines is not on the same scale as Indian and Chinese manufacturers. While many Indian and South Korean companies have expressed interest in manufacturing the Sputnik V, they have yet to start doing so. Only one South Korean company, Hankook Chorus Farm, has started production of Sputnik V, and a large consortium of South Korean companies has signed up to manufacture 500 million doses. Five Indian companies, Hetero Biopharma, Gland Pharma, Stelis Biopharma, Virchow Biotech, and Panacea Biotech, have inked deals with the Russian Direct Investment Fund, or RDIF, for setting up a combined production capacity of 850 million doses. Meanwhile, even as India looks to ramp up its current vaccine production to meet the worldwide demand, it has not been able to do so. Well, dear listeners, that was the first part of an article by Prabir Purkayaswa. The piece is titled "The West Practicing Vaccine Apartheid at a Global Level." Tune in tomorrow for the second and concluding part of this article. Until then, goodbye and God bless.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM, 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via Internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Forty recommendations by Imam Khamenei for the journey towards God. Plead to God. The second point is that all kinds of requests, even small ones, can and should be made to God during these prayers, supplications and dhikrs. However, you should not confine your requests to minor needs. There are greater needs and requests which should not be forgotten. The greatest request is divine forgiveness. You should ask God to remove signs of sin and violation from your hearts and souls. You should ask God to smooth the path of repentance for you. Another great request is divine kindness. You should ask Allah the Exalted to bestow His kindness on you. Another great request is correcting the affairs of the Islamic Ummah. You should ask Allah the Exalted to correct the affairs of all Muslims, not only the people of Iran and all Islamic countries. You should ask Him to guide humanity towards the straight path. These prayers have a good chance of being answered. They are the ones which are answered. They open the path and prepare the ground. They help us to reach great goals.
عم العباد يا خير زاد رمضان يا شهر القرآن فيك أذوق حلاوة الإيمان لا لا تنقضي أنت للروح دواء رمضان 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 ليتك دوما قريب
Returning to God. To feel guilty, there is no need to commit sins for years. No, even a single sin counts. Sins must not be underestimated. In a hadith about underestimating sins, it is narrated that underestimation of sins is disapproved. The reason for this is that God has said, "We will forgive." For this reason, repentance and returning to God is very important. Not that committing a sin is unimportant or trivial. On the contrary, it is very dangerous. But returning to God, paying attention to God and dhikr are so important that if done honestly and correctly, then that incurable diseases will be cured. Multidimensional blessings. Dua brings one closer to God. It makes knowledge effective and permanent in the heart. It strengthens faith, and this is all besides what is asked for in the dua, which is a supplication to God and is, God willing, fulfilled. So, dua has multidimensional blessings. That is why the Holy Quran repeatedly speaks about dua and supplications by pious servants of God. This is all a lesson for us.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.